And now, the Big D and Bubba Weekly Podcast.
Big D and Bubba, they have a show 5 days a week, but they don't get to say everything that's on their mind, so they have an extra one, and that's how we get the podcast,
podcast.
Big D and Bubba podcast,
we're podcasting.
Big D and Bubba podcast.
Big shout out to Patrick for doing the greatest podcast theme ever.
Hi there.
It's the best. The podcast is sponsored by Match. Now, hold on a minute. Patrick, you need to come look at this. I have my information about the podcast. It says the podcast is sponsored by Match.com.
But
yet
yet
you have the National Highway Safety.
That first part is wrong. Sponsored by the National Highway.
Okay. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. So if you're driving and you don't know, not using your seatbelt can actually land you in a hospital bed. So buckle up before it is too late. You don't get a second chance. Click it or ticket.
Hey, joining us on the podcast today is Peter Cooper. He's a senior director, producer, and writer of the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum.
Hey, Peter!
He has a new book called Johnny's Cash and Charlie's Pride, Lasting Legends and Untold Adventures in Country Music. And we're glad to have him in the studio with us. How are you, man? Good to see you, Peter.
I'm doing great. Good to be here.
So you are the one who knows more than anyone else, probably, or one of, more than me, on the history of country music and, the Hall of Fame celebrating its 50th anniversary. And there are if you've never been to the Hall of Fame in Nashville, you definitely need to.
It's amazing because every time you go, it's different.
Yeah, all these different artifacts and different things going on. You can do a Jason exhibit now. Jason Aldean exhibit.
That just opened today, right? Today
it did.
Yeah.
So we celebrated last night. That's a good thing about opening exhibits is you get to have a big
party.
Yeah.
Well, Jason was there?
You get to have cake and beer about it. And Jason was there. Yeah.
What's at the exhibit with him? Is it clothes and guitars and that kind of stuff?
Oh, it's beyond that. It's clothes and guitars, sure. But there's some stuff from his childhood, high school graduation photo. There's a car hood that snuck in there somehow.
What?
Some kind of NASCAR affiliation.
Anything from his baseball days?
Yes. There is some stuff from his baseball days. There's a high school jacket.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Jason and Patrick were in this parking lot in the back here playing a wiffle ball home run derby once.
I came this close to striking him out.
He almost
struck out. I had two strikes on him, and then he cranked one.
Damn. Well, the other thing, too, is he was batting left-handed.
Yeah.
Just to give Patrick the advantage. Never told Patrick. It was straight out of the
Princess Bride. I'm not really left-handed.
So, that's how it went down.
So at the Hall of Fame, I know that you're the director, senior director, producer, and writer, but what do you do?
To go with the baseball analogy, I play utility infield, basically. Whatever they need. I'm sometimes collecting for exhibits. I'm sometimes writing the things that you read, if you like to read when you're walking around there. I'm sometimes doing public programs. I'll do interviews where every weekend there's something going on at the museum where people can come in. Like 2 weeks ago, I was interviewing Ricky Skaggs. Tomorrow, it's Roseanne
Cash and her
sisters.
You mean in front of an audience. You know, there's an audience watching the...
Oh, so it's not like a closed door thing. There are people there
who
can... Do they jump in and ask questions of their own?
They heckle.
That's cool.
No, they... sometimes
we heckle.
Sometimes we have it so that they can ask questions of their own, and sometimes it's just a conversation. But it's always something interesting. We got lots of audiovisual stuff. Like we're going to have Johnny Cash's four daughters in there and showing photos from a scrapbook, a family scrapbook.
Like things that nobody's seen.
Yeah, that nobody's seen.
Wow.
Or interviewing the great songwriter John Prine in front of people and pulling up video footage and demos, things like that. This is really a living museum. It's something different happening all the time, from exhibits being changed out to the activities there. It's a cool place, man.
You're grabbing something, collecting that kind of, you sit there and you go, oh my gosh, I'm holding blank.
Hank Williams Sr.'s this and that, or whatever it may be.
Yeah. I don't often hold I'm not a curator per se over there. So we have people that walk around with white gloves and
right.
hold that stuff. But yeah,
they really wear white gloves.
Yeah, they really wear
remember
white gloves.
Remember the guy? We met a guy from
Graceland,
and he brought us some things from Elvis, mm-hmm. and we had to wear white gloves to be able to hold them.
Yeah, museum practices is a serious thing. You can go to jail.
Really?
No.
Oh. Well, I don't know. I mean, how am I supposed to know?
He's not the easiest one to figure out. It's taking a little time, but I think we're on to him now.
No, every day that I'm in that place, I get that weird ghosty feeling.
Is there a ghost there?
Man, it's the youngest haunted building that there is. That building came up in the early 2000s, and it does feel that way. At 5 o'clock, our visitors leave, and if you're walking around and you're standing next to Hank Williams Sr.'s guitar that he wrote songs on, or you're standing next to Mother Maybelle Carter's 1928 Gibson that she invented the way that we all play guitar.
Country music guitar, yes.
Right.
And everyone afterwards has copied it.
And you know, after the sun goes down, everything comes alive.
Well, the thing is,
yeah.
What movie is that? The Night at the Museum?
Yes.
Yeah. No, I've been in that building after hours.
No, it was a Kenny Chesney song, I think.
I've been in that building after hours a dozen times, and it's always got this. I've never seen a ghost, but I always feel like I'm going to see a ghost.
You ever seen a ghost, Peter?
I'm not sure. I've seen some weird stuff.
What did you see that you...
I feel this aura around these, particularly the instruments, these things that were actually used by people to take their life of the mind and bring it into our minds and ears.
Do you think that there is an energy that things, inanimate objects can
like
absorb?
It follows things everywhere?
And then there are times when it
like
releases
the force?
It? Yeah.
I don't know if it's carried within those objects or if it's something that we project onto them, but I have a guitar at my house that was played by Tom T. Hall, and he wrote songs like Little Bitty on this guitar, and when I'm gonna write a song, I'm gonna pick up that guitar and see what he left in there. It just puts you in a state of mind.
Wouldn't that be cool if like you pick it up, even like somebody who doesn't know how to play, but they pick it up and it's like magic shoes. You put it on and you can run like Usain Bolt.
Yeah. Yeah, that hadn't worked so far for me, but yeah, that would be great.
Still holding out hope.
Yeah, okay. I am.
I'm gonna do something that may be a little bit wrong here because Peter has a new book that he wrote, and he has great stories about the Hall of Fame and country music and some really cool stuff. We're going to get to that, but I'm going to start this off with something a little bit controversial.
Ooh, we like controversy.
I want to say in advance that I know that people who work for the Hall of Fame actually work for the museum, and they don't have anything to do
with who is and who is not in
the Hall of Fame.
Yeah,
and I know
correct.
That. So I'm not accusing you. I have accused Kyle Young, the president of the Hall of Fame,
CEO.
On this show in the past, and even though I knew he wasn't the guy, I still wanted him to account for it. But I'm going to ask you, it's Hank Williams Jr.'s birthday.
Yep.
And I have been on this campaign for, 3 years now to try to get Hank Williams Jr. in the Hall of Fame.
We even created a Facebook page.
Yes, we have a petition and a Facebook page, and we talk about it on the air.
It would help
if
he had some hits or some longevity.
Something like that.
Some kind of iconic status.
Yes.
The number one response I get when I tell people, artists, musicians, just people from all over the U.S., people from Europe, and I say, well, yeah, did you know Hank Williams Jr. is not in the Hall of Fame? The number one answer is, yes, he is.
Yeah.
They just assume it.
That's right.
Because we all assume
can
that
can you
Bo
give
Seifert
me one good reason Hank Williams Jr., as a historian, as someone who has covered country music for your whole life, and as a musician, can you give me one good reason he's not in the Hall of Fame?
No.
Is there anyone out there that has it is more glaring absence from the rotunda than Bo Seifert? And I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot, but feel free to be honest.
I want to be honest, and I'll say there are some people who would say that Jerry Lee Lewis is an egregious absence from the Hall of Fame. Some people might say more so than Bo Seifert. I don't know. It's hard to make your heroes arm wrestle with each other.
That's true.
Also, But no, I can't give you a good reason. One reason, I guess, is that this is the most exclusive of halls of fame in music. Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, they'll put in 7 or 8 in a year, no yeah. problem. And you know, all of a sudden, it's you know, it's Nickelback's year.
That'll happen
soon.
One day.
It's coming soon.
You know that, right?
This yeah. Hall of Fame puts in 3 artists per year, and they do it through categories. There's a modern category. There's a veterans era category, which Bo Cephas would be eligible for because he started his career so long ago
yeah.
as a young man. And then there's a rotating category that's either
songwriters, musicians, and executives.
That is correct.
So he's not eligible for that one.
Right. So he's eligible for the one category, the veterans category, that this year Jerry Reed will be inducted in that category. And I can't give you a good reason for Jerry Reed not to be in there either. I'm not saying...
Agreed.
Yeah. So it's an exclusive Hall of Fame. This will bring the total of the total number of Hall of Famers on October 22nd when we have our medallion ceremony. It'll be to 133. And that's... through the
history
of country music. But, man, I'm not going to...
That sounds like a lot, but it's really not a lot when you think of the big picture of how many people have been in there. And you take that number and you pull the songwriters and people that have been in the industry out, and that number gets even smaller for artists.
Yes.
So it's even more exclusive.
Think about how many new artists come along every year and the chances... You know, even incredible crops like the class of 89, where you had Alan Jackson, who's going to go in this year, and Travis Tritt and Mary Chapin Carpenter and Clint Black and Garth Brooks. I mean, there'll be 2 of that class this year.
And that's been almost 30 years. So I don't know. I can't think of anything more absent than it's Bo Cephas, man. It's Bo Cephas. I have a thing we created where we have, there were like 11 number one songs in the course of the last decade that name drop Bo Cephas.
Yeah.
He's clearly one of the most influential artists, you know, on today's country music, and to the point that people are literally using his name in their songs more than anyone else.
He gets it, guys. I'm
not trying to explain it to him. I'm mostly just taking another opportunity to beat the drum. So maybe if anyone else is watching, anyone from the CMA who's on the voting committee, if you're
that's what I was going to say, or if somebody runs into somebody and go, why is Bo Cephas not in here? And then maybe they start voting and putting him up there. Who nominates? And that's kind of a fascinating thing too. Like, who actually nominates the people for the Hall of Fame?
There are committees of voting members of the Country Music Association, so industry professionals who've been at it a long time. And it is not a publicly known panel, so you can't say, so-and-so is a voter this
That's
year,
good,
so I'm
going to
call, right. you know, I'm going to go
I can tell
mow
you
his
that
yard.
All 3 of us who are voting members, none of us are on that committee.
Right. You're a voting member for the CMA awards,
yeah, but
for the regular yearly awards,
right.
but not for the Hall of Fame. Yeah, it's a pretty small group from what I hear.
Well, Big D's right. We don't want to hound you about it because it's obviously not yours, but it was just...
It's Bo Cephas' birthday, so
It is his birthday.
It
He's been bugging us all morning. We had to play Bo Cephas so much today. He's like, you got to play, do some more. Yeah. So we have now made his day, and we can go on to pushing your agenda because this is big. We're talking about the museum. We're talking about the Hall of Fame part of it, and we can also mention your book because that's a big deal too.
Well, to me.
Yeah, it is.
What is the book about?
It's stories. It's kind of what you guys sit around every day and do. It's stories about country music and the people that make it and my interactions with a lot of them. Sometimes it's the story behind the story. I wrote for the Tennessean newspaper for many years, and there's the part that you write in the paper, and then there's the other stuff that goes
on.
How
you got there, yeah.
And so it's got stories about, Leanne Womack confronting me after a review.
I actually know a little bit of this story. So
a record review?
Yeah, this is like 12 years ago. You're working for the Tennessean.
Yeah.
And Leanne Womack's album, I'm trying to remember the name.
There's more where that came from.
It's 2005, I think. And you wrote a review in the Tennessean.
Yeah, a positive review, by the way.
Was it?
Yeah.
Because I've always heard it was a bad review.
Oh, no. No, it was a positive review.
Positive review to you?
And it
or and not her?
No, it was really a positive review, period. But she, I start that little section of the book by saying, you know, don't twist my arm and make me tell you who's the best singer in Nashville, because that hurts. But if you did twist my arm and ask about the best singer in Nashville, the answer might be Leanne Womack. I mean, I've never heard somebody.
That's a nice beginning.
Yeah. I've never heard somebody in a room singing without a microphone that's had that kind of immediacy. Maybe Dolly Parton. Maybe.
And we've actually talked with Aubrey, her daughter, about how there's a lot of similarities between her vocally and tonally and Dolly. I mean, they have that thing, and it's awesome.
Yeah. So I'm so glad I don't have to write record reviews anymore. But I wrote a review of this album that people were calling it her career album. It was a real step forward for her. Actually, a step forward by moving back and being even more rooted in the soundscape. And I wrote that, well, yes, this is a good album, but you know, don't call it a career album. You know, she'll do better. She's Leanne
she'll
Womack.
Do better is the thing that sat bad.
Yeah, yeah,
she'll do better. Yeah, yeah. Yes, Peter, you're an idiot. I don't know how you didn't know.
Before that, did you know any women? Because maybe that was the problem.
She'll do better.
Yeah.
Okay.
So. If I may, I'll pick up here.
Sure.
So I wound up writing a review that asserted her greatness, but also said this was not her career album and that she could and would do even better than this. I was in Atlanta late at night, leaving a piano bar, don't ask, when my cell phone rang and I distractedly picked up. Hello? Peter Cooper? The words came out as one. Peter Cooper? Yes. Where in it? Something are you? I'm in Atlanta. Why? Well, that one was hard to answer. I paused to ponder. Doesn't matter. Get your sorry butt over here right now. I can't. I'm in Atlanta. Well, get in your car and drive to Nashville, because I'm going to give you 3 swift kicks to the groin. That didn't sound particularly appealing. I don't know. I read what you wrote. You're saying I can do better? I can do better? Buoyed by distance from a violent volley of feet, I answered honestly. Yes, you can. Are you saying you can? Are you saying this is the best you'll ever do? Are you saying you've peaked? The next few minutes held flurries of profanity. I tried to adjust my telephone's volume to no avail. She let me have it. And then the next few minutes became the next 20 minutes. Some people would pay big money to talk to Leanne Womack for 20 minutes. I silently consoled myself. But those people would be deeply regretful if the discussion went like this one did. In the end, she vowed she would indeed do better, if only to stick it up my sorry self, which might indeed be better than 3 swift kicks to the groin. Next time I saw Leanne was at Madison Square Garden in October of 2005. I was headed to a backstage bathroom. She was holding 3 shining trophies, having dominated the Country Music Association Awards, winning Vocal Event of the Year for a George Strait duet, Single of the Year for I May Hate Myself in the Morning, and
Album of the Year.
There's more where that came from. I was walking one way alone. She was walking the other, surrounded by glad-handing handlers. I didn't think she would notice me. As I passed on her right, she stuck out her arm like an angry crossing guard in a stop signal. I stopped. Then she closed her fist, then pointed her index and middle fingers at me, and then separated those fingers slowly but ultimately severely. Congratulations, I said. She just said, spread them. Oof.
Didn't she make you a t-shirt?
She did. Yeah, that's not in the book, but she did eventually make me a t-shirt that said, I took 3 swift kicks to the groin and all I got was this lousy t-shirt.
See, that's great.
She is...
she's a firecracker.
She is. And you know what's funny is that when you... Well, people who are Leanne Womack fans but don't know her like you do don't see that part of her because she's kind of, you know, this nerd.
She plays the sweet girl very well.
Once the on-air button hit, she's a little careful with her answers.
Is there an artist that that is like that, another artist that's their public persona is not at all how they really are? Or they have maybe 2 personas.
I'm not sure about the public persona part being that different, but I think the way that people take them may be different. The way that people interpret them, like Alison Krauss, you know, everybody says voice of an angel, and that's assuming we know that the angels are really super good singers.
We would hope so.
I mean, but, oh, voice, she's just angelic. You hear that word, angelic, so much about Alison Krauss, and she is marvelous. She would be in the discussion about greatest singer in Nashville. But she's hilarious. I mean, she could have a stand-up routine. You know, she could go on the comedy circuit. She's that funny, and people don't think of her that way. She's
never thought of her that way.
Yeah, she's a hoot.
She seems very quiet and reserved, and then she steps up to the microphone and lets out ungodly sounds that no one else can make. And then
angelic sounds.
Yeah,
not ungodly. And then godly.
You don't picture her being. You know,
she's a riot. She is a laugh riot.
I'm trying to think if there's anyone we know that's like that. That's very different.
That's real different.
Yeah.
Somebody who I think is very similar is Vince. I think Vince is he is what you see what you get kind of thing. And whenever he comes in, he can kind of be reserved at times, almost dismissive. When he's been in the studio with us before, almost
not
like
dismissive in a negative way though.
No, and dismissive in a negative way. like he, you know, just kind of like he didn't really want to be here. And I don't know if there's something going on or whatever, but as soon as we kind of got into it and he kind of loosened, then it was fine. And then it was the kind of the joke cracking, you know, fun loving. He's really dry. His sense of humor is very, very dry, very similar to yours. And, but he's a guy that will do anything for anyone. I mean, I can't think of any other artists that has done more charity work than Vince and Amy, especially Vince.
And more for other artists, you know?
Yeah.
We made fun of Vince because, like, you know, has anyone ever asked you to play on an album and you actually said no?
Right.
Because, I mean...
Well, wasn't there a 6 degrees of Vince Gill thing?
Oh, yeah. There was a website. Before his last album where you could see, you know, every artist you could think of was less than 6 degrees away from Vince Gill.
And that's everyone, like, in history.
Oh, yeah.
That guy is incredible. I'll give you a story on him. It's not just like, yeah, here's a donation for your whatever, or yes, I'll play the benefit. He was a big fan of a dobro player, a guy named Mike Aldridge, who's well-known in the bluegrass and acoustic music worlds. And Mike was living up in the Washington, D.C. area, and he had cancer. And Vince was coming up with his band to play a show in D.C. in that area, and he asked Mike if Mike would play the show with him. And Mike said yes, and then as it got closer, Mike started to worry about his ability to his stamina for playing through a whole show. So Mike gets there to the venue and says to Vince Gill, he says, well, Vince, man, is it possible for me to sit? Could I have a seat? I don't think I can do this. And the band's already up there. Everybody's standing up at their microphones. And most of us in that position would say, oh, yeah, of course you can sit. But let's get Mike a seat. Vince, in that instant, goes, you know, let's all sit. I'd love to do a show where we just all sit. And he said, can we get chairs for everybody and move these mics down?
So it doesn't call Mike out.
Right. Exactly.
It doesn't make him look like, why is that guy sitting?
Right. And
it's like Adam Sandler when he peed on himself in Billy Madison. No, remember? You know what I'm talking about?
That's what it reminded me of. It is. Exactly it was Vince Gill's Adam Sandler pee moment.
All the cool kids pee on themselves. Let's all sit.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. No, that like I say, it's one thing to be a nice guy or to, you know, try to do nice things for people, but it's another thing to have that kind of emotional intelligence to just snap in that moment. Go, yeah we're all sitting.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's who Vince Gill is.
Is Alan Jackson super shy?
Yes. Yes.
Almost painfully shy. Like
painful to me.
I think that a lot of people take him as
standoffish.
He's, you know, stuck up, and but he's not.
But no, not at all. Because as soon as every time we've had a run in with him, as soon as you get him kind of comfortable, he opens up, and he's just great.
He's a fascinating guy to interview in a one-on-one situation. He doesn't like. There's this thing that happens a lot in Nashville, which is a whole bunch of people in a crowded room talking over each other. Hey, how you been? What's going on? And kind of looking over each other's shoulder to see if somebody hotter just walked in the room. Mm-hmm. I think that's Alan's nightmare. He just doesn't like that. Some people love that kind of thing, and he just doesn't. It's not the way he was raised. It's not the kind of thing he enjoys. But, man, you get him one-on-one, or as you say, in a situation where he's comfortable, and he's a, you know, obviously he's a hyper-intelligent guy too. He wrote those songs,
yeah,
you know, most of them by himself.
True.
And but yeah, it's just the kind of mechanisms of the music industry don't always jibe with the way that Alan
he's one
wants
of my
to
favorites.
Live his life.
He is one of my favorites. Like out of that whole, and like it's so weird because, and this is going to sound almost sacrilegious to country fans. During the time that Alan was at his hottest, to me, he was okay. But I have come to appreciate Alan Jackson's music here in the last 5 years on a different level. Like, during that era, it was George Strait and pretty much everyone else. But I now...
And Garth.
But Garth kind of stepped back. So, yeah, in that era, George owned it because Garth went away on his own. I now put Alan equally... with George Strait and anybody, Garth, you name it, of that whole era. He's not just a peer, he is an equal. And I love Alan Jackson.
Well, there's a reason he's the second person from that famous class of 89 year, all these new acts came to go in. It was Garth. George was in before, and he was came along before. And then Garth, and then now Alan Jackson's going to be in the Hall of Fame.
Like, when is the last time you've just gone back and revisited some of the Alan stuff?
Every weekend.
Yeah, I was gonna say, Patrick, I know go to the jukebox and you throw on the sad ones.
For me, it's every day I've been doing that because Alan on October 22nd will be officially inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame, and I've got to work on the program to make sure that all happens properly. So I'm doing deep listening every day to Alan Jackson and to Don Schlitz and to Jerry Reed, the other inductees.
I was going to ask you something about, what impresses you more, a songwriter or an artist? Let's say the songwriter doesn't sing and the artist doesn't write.
Two different things. That's like saying...
Now you have to pick. You got to pick.
Man, it's like, what impresses you more, a crab cake or hockey? You know,
crab cake.
Okay.
See, I can answer. I can give you an answer.
Crab cake. All right.
I love hockey, but I love crab cakes.
It depends completely on the songwriter. And the performer. I really can't. And one of the things I try to write about in this book is the silliness of making music into competition like it's sports. But it's a completely different thing to sit down in a room and write a song and pour your heart out. That's very different than what Kenny Chesney does when he's sitting down to plan a stadium tour and get it second by second exactly what is going to happen in that show to make sure that 50,000 people are entertained. They're very different things. I don't think one is more important than the other. They're both very necessary.
Sure. You ever hear a song or run across a song that maybe kind of making the rounds in the background in Nashville that you're kind of like, oh, man, this song's going to be huge, and nothing ever comes of it?
Yeah, all the time. I don't believe the thing that people say about, well, the great song, you know.
The cream rises.
The cream rises. It sometimes does. If you would just put a sometimes on the back of that, that'd be fine. But sometimes it doesn't. Some of the most devastating songs I've ever heard didn't do anything. Man, I'm hearing some stuff right now that I just don't understand why it's not everywhere. There's a guy named Charlie Worsham who has a song called Cut Your Groove that I've seen him play in front of audiences that were totally unfamiliar with it, and they go bonkers for this song. It's this anthem. And
I see everybody Googling now.
Well, it's
a great record.
It's worth a Google. And that guy's... an unbelievable, he's like a Vince Gill, Keith Urban level talent.
For guitar?
Guitar, songwriter, he's that guy. And I look at that and you just have to realize that it's not a competition, that the greatest guitar player in Nashville is probably playing for tips on Lower Broad or something. You know, might be. It's not that there are incredible talents who rise, but there are incredible talents.
And you got to remember that there are those talents that, you know, you don't have to get a record deal, a tour, stadiums to be considered a success. Maybe you'll make more money, but you know, you look at like Aaron Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
Aaron kind of was burned on the whole Nashville experience,
he was burned on music for a while.
And, you know, and for good reason. You know, he came in and they called his baby ugly. And he's like, well, you know what? I'm going to take my ball and go home. And that's what he did. And all of a sudden, it's interesting how that now that it's getting more and more success commercially with this new album, that now you get these Nashville guys who are like, whoa, what's hey. And, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if he's going to – I don't know what his deal is at all. But
when I was in the ninth grade, it got drilled into my head, what is right is not always popular and what is popular is not always right. It's the same thing. You can say that about music with what is great. What's great is not always popular and what's popular is not always great.
And what's great can be great to different people for different reasons. You know, that was the thing I saw when Taylor Swift came out at first, and there's this teenage girl singing about high school concerns, and there were a bunch of, you know, grumpy old people going, well, that ain't country music. It's like, man, it's not meant for you. It's obviously means something to these people over here, you know, these teenage girls who are buying guitars and writing songs and viewing this as an inspiration. And probably if you're 16 years old writing songs that appeal to 15-year-olds, you one day you'll be 35 years old writing songs that appeal to 34-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
It's being angry about music doesn't
No, that's
doesn't
such a
help
weird
anything.
Thing. And there's a lot of that in this town where people were angry about what's popular and
I look
what's
at
not
it like
popular.
This, you know, if you're writing from the heart, and that goes with anything, whether it's, you know, she was writing what she knew. That was her world. That was her life. So it makes perfect sense that that's what the songs were about. And obviously, as she has grown and matured, so has her music.
Yeah.
I'm going to say something that's going to shock Big D and Bubba.
What?
Which is that I think the best singer in this town right now is Chris Stapleton.
What?
It's not even close
Patrick,
to me.
Patrick, really?
I know. Isn't that
so
shocking, you guys, that I would say that? But that's been a consensus among people in the music industry for about a decade.
Yes.
And
since
it
was singing
until,
at the Station Inn.
Yeah, it wasn't until, you know, a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago at the CMA Awards, where people finally went, hey, you know what? That guy's pretty great.
Yeah.
But it's just one of those things. We were all walking around for years going, why don't more people like Chris Stapleton? I don't understand. I've never heard anyone sing like that. Live. I've never seen anyone drop a room so silent like that with an acoustic guitar and a simple song about drinking whiskey, which are my favorite. But
they really are. Simple songs
sad
and whiskey.
Songs about whiskey and your woman leaving are to me the stuff that makes country music. I think everything else is just okay.
And just like he says, that's for him. For someone else, it may be
drinking beer in a cornfield.
Look at what I was listening to yesterday. I was rolling around listening to the new Colt Ford album, just rocking it. And there's a song called Dirt Floor Disco that I'm like totally down for now. It used to be my least favorite song on the album, and now it's my favorite. I love that stuff.
Yeah.
So it's like it's interesting how country is different for everyone.
Yeah, and right now we're in a place for our format where a lot of new sounds are being introduced, and sounds that are not traditionally country sounds, you know, and it's easy for people who grew up with the steel guitars and all that to kind of push back on it.
Yeah, but it's weird though. Country music really has always been in that position. You walk through the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum, and you're going to see the Carter family who were playing on an auto harp and an acoustic guitar and singing. Then you're going to see display that you're going to learn about Ernest Tubb, who brought the electric guitar into country music popularity and prominence. And there
who was
were people,
the first to put the drum into country? Because obviously drums weren't part of it in the beginning.
There was Ernest Tubb often played with a drum. I think Bob Wills.
Was the one that. It was the big controversy on the Opry that Bob Wills wanted to bring a drummer on the Opry. Hank Williams had a steel guitar, which we think of as
the
center
say,
of country.
Yeah.
But was he the first, or was that just really new and he made it more popular?
No, but at some point these acoustic instruments became electrified, you know, and you could play what was essentially a dobro, and then they electrify that and put some pedals on it, and it's a pedal steel guitar, and that becomes traditional. Country music.
Or traditional Hawaiian music.
Right, right. Elvis comes along in July of 1954 and rises to popularity. Many nights the Opry at the Ryman was like a quarter full because so many people went from the country stuff over into Elvis world. And in trying to figure out how to react to that, the country producers like Owen Bradley and Chet Atkins take some steel guitar and fiddle out and put some big backing vocal choruses and piano, tinkling piano in and create what we now call
slapback echo.
Slapback echo and call it the Nashville sound. And that's Patsy Cline and Jim Reeves. And we think
Eddie
of that
Arnold
as traditional.
And those guys. Yeah, and that's traditional now, but that was pop music to purists.
There are always in this genre, more than in a lot of genres, there are always people who are like, well, that's new. That's got to be bad. I mean, in bluegrass, which has a definitive start date of December 8th, 1945, was when Earl Scruggs joined Bill Monroe on the Grand Ole Opry stage and created what we now call bluegrass. There are people in bluegrass who think that anything that doesn't sound like that is way too far forward.
Yeah, you know? My brother-in-law is the same way. Like, he is a bluegrass purist, and I love bluegrass cover songs. I got playlist after playlist of all that dumb stuff, and it's just great. You know, hearing Nickelback, you said that, but Nickelback songs done bluegrass are better. They just are.
Of course.
But he gets mad because they'll be like
Nickelback
somebody with...
done by me is better.
Oh, man. Every tradition in this music is born of innovation. It started somewhere, and there was somebody there to gripe about it. And I think it, in some ways, people growing up now in this era where you've got the entirety of recorded popular music at your fingertips, probably for free, which is another discussion, but it might be insincere if you grew up hearing a lot of hip-hop to not have that be part of your musical sound. It might be kind of weird if what you're supposed to be doing is revealing some of yourself in all of your songs, which is what Cowboy Jack Clement said we should do. I think it would be weird if Sam Hunt just came out with a fiddle and steel combo.
It's real hard because as we're the guest gatekeepers, you know, we're the guys who play the songs on the radio, we have to find a balance between the traditional sound, the pop sound, and then the really progressive stuff. And it's really tough. Patrick does a great job. He is our music director for the show. And we have argument after argument after argument about songs. And we disagree a lot. And you know what? He's usually right in the end. So we usually trust him on that. But
you have to trust the audience. If people want to hear songs they want to hear. They want. I mean, people think it's a conspiracy in radio. I hear it all the time. Well, radio only plays what they want you to hear. Trust me. If I could make everyone like the music I like, it would be all Randy Rogers Band and Chris Stapleton and Eric Paslay and these guys all the time.
Yeah.
Okay? But I can't – that's not how it works. It's not a conspiracy. We play what people want to hear. The record companies make music that they think people want to buy. That's it.
What's interesting to me is where those things diverge, which is – I mean, you mentioned Stapleton. He – recently here had the number one and number two album on the country charts.
In the same week.
That's pretty good. In the same week to be at number one and number two.
Is that good?
Yeah, that's good.
Pretty good.
I'm an insider. I'm going to let you in on this. That's really...
It's a secret, dude.
Peter Cooper is with us, Senior Director of Country Music Hall of Fame Museum. All right, go ahead.
Senior Director, producer, and writer.
Get them all in there.
There's a CEO who really runs things. I don't want to give anybody the impression that I'm
in charge.
Right.
Anyway, back to number one and number two.
Yeah, so Chris Stapleton sells a whole bunch of albums. He sold more albums last year than I think all but either three or four acts of any genre. And yet it's not represented on radio.
Well, I could get into the details of why that happened, but that was about...
Go ahead.
That was about single choices and timing, and I don't want to make enemies with my friends at the record label. But yeah, I think they put the wrong songs out at the wrong time. The day after the CMA Awards, the single should have been Tennessee Whiskey by Chris Stapleton. That was never... If people say, why don't y'all play that song? Never released as a single to radio to play. So,
but why do we have to... Well, we can still play what we want to play.
We don't. But again, I mean, at some point, you want to play the songs people are looking forward to hearing. So you want to play the current singles.
This is a big dance. And so we've got to kind of... We can't go off and doing our thing.
We did for 3 weeks. We played Tennessee Whiskey as a you know, power current. And,
because that's, all,
and
that's people,
what people were
people
wanting
were
to hear.
Calling us, play Tennessee whiskey more.
I got asked every one of those weeks why we were playing that instead of the single, which was Parachute. I'm like, because nobody knows Parachute, and this is a number one song. Look hey, by the way, look at the Billboard chart. It's the number one song. Not in country music, in all music. Yeah. That was the number one song. Why weren't we playing it on the radio? And it's not, well, country radio won't play it. That was never a single. Fire Away, the second most popular song on that album, if you look at jukeboxes or sales, is Fire Away. Fire Away, never released as a single to mainstream radio. It was released in Texas to Texas radio stations, but not to us. So I don't like when radio as a group gets the blame for, well, you guys don't play Chris Stapleton. Hey, I played Parachute, and I played Nobody to Blame was actually the single after the CMAs. And we played that, but we would have played Tennessee Whiskey a lot more, but... Not that was somebody else's choice.
Take that, Peter.
Well, there you go. I like how it goes.
There you go.
Yeah, whatever.
I actually called everyone I could think of at that record label the day after the CMAs and went, please.
But they didn't have, you know, the beautiful thing is they didn't have to make Tennessee Whiskey a single because it was already so big because of the talk. They're like, well, let's put something else out there because we could sell two songs instead of just one.
You know what? It would have been better. I don't know if it would have been better for them, but it would have been better for us if we had been playing that song.
That's why I say it's a dance.
It is a dance.
And we all have to kind of communicate, talk. How are we going to do this? Because we're... Like you said, it all boils down to what does the audience want?
Well, and we have that dance at the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum as well. There are people who go there because they want to be close to the deep history of things. There are people who go there because they love the contemporary radio format and want to see people represented from that. Now, we're lucky that we're a huge place and we have the opportunity to put on an exhibit on Jason Aldean and on Johnny Cash, and we have a wonderful gallery that is devoted to just to what's called American Currents. That's just what's happened over the past year. You know, notable things and notable artists that made
that's really smart
an
of the museum.
The
as
American
well
Currents
to be doing
exhibit.
That.
This is the first year you've done that, right?
Mm-hmm, it
so
is.
It's all about 2016. So everything that happened last year, you can go in and see Chris Stapleton's outfit that he wore to the CMAs and things
here's
like
some
and
all spit the, from a trombone.
Yeah, very no, there's none of that.
Because what's happening now will, it's going to be history and it matters. And if we as a museum just say, well, we're just going to focus on the stuff from 50 years ago and before that, then we're ignoring important things that are going on. We have to represent the past and the present and the things that are setting the pace for the future.
Well,
things
the present like, stuff is the stuff that gets some of the newer fans excited. So when they go with their mom.
Well, it brings you into the party.
Yeah.
Right. And that's it cycles through, like you've had exhibits on Luke Bryan and Eric Church and Blake Shelton, but those cycle through. So there's always a chance to have those guys in. It doesn't mean that the other stuff's not still there. You can still see Elvis's solid gold Cadillac, and Hank Williams' music note suit, which are to me my favorite. What's your favorite artifact in the museum?
Probably the. There's the squirrels that Hank Williams Sr. shot at his Franklin Road residence, and they were taxidermied and made to appear. They're four squirrels, and they were made to appear like one of the squirrels is Hank Williams, and one of the steel guitar playing squirrel is Don Helms from Hank Williams Band.
That's
Hank Williams
fantastic.
And his Driftin' Cowboys Band, but it's dead squirrels. That's the first thing I show people.
That's fantastic.
And then there's nothing else to really
display?
Show.
I don't even remember seeing
it's
that.
On display. It's kind of hidden in a corner. You got to know somebody,
But we know somebody.
It's actually
listen,
in,
we
so,
do. Okay, a little secret. Where is that, Peter?
It's in the Taylor Swift Education Center.
Is it really?
For some reason, that's funny to me.
Behind behind glass there. Yeah. And the first time I saw it, it was at Hank Jr.'s place when I was interviewing Hank Jr., years ago, and he's been showing me his Civil War cannons and all that, and the places where he'll put a pig in the ground and have some beer on ice. And he goes, now you really want to see something? I was like, yeah, I really want to see something. He goes, check this out. And he opens this closet door, and there were the taxidermied squirrels. And seeing something.
When Bo Cephas, let's go to that moment. When Bo Cephas has you in his house and says, you really want to see something?
Yeah.
What do do you think is behind that door before it turns out to be dead squirrels?
Not dead squirrels. Not dead squirrels.
Something else. Something
a guitar. No. Dead. See, I mean, I thought it might be artillery because he's
right
rife with that, you know, his place. But yeah, it was dead squirrels that his daddy, Hank Sr., shot.
Dude, I can't wait to go back to the Hall of Fame just to take a picture of the dead squirrels. I didn't know that was
well,
there.
You know, we do that. We actually have a little thing, I guess, that we don't really talk about, but we give taxidermy to friends.
That's true.
You know, we've given things to Blake Shelton and different things like that. But actually the Blake Shelton thing is a great running gag because anytime I see interesting taxidermy, I'll take a picture of it and just send it to him, you know, kind of thing. And it's like, oh, where is that? I got to have that because he likes weird taxidermy.
This is actually a pretty good story. I don't know if we've ever told on the podcast. So 15 years ago, Blake was in the studio.
When he was kind of like a newer artist, yeah.
We had a bullfrog.
Mullet Blake.
Full on Mullet Blake. We had a bullfrog with, it was originally a baby raccoon.
Yes.
Right. This is taxidermy, so they were real. So it's a baby raccoon riding a bullfrog like a bull. With his hand, one hand up in the air and his other hand on the...
Had a little cowboy hat on.
Yeah, look, had a little cowboy hat. It was great. And Blake said, if you ever get rid of that, I want that. And we were like, oh, okay, yeah, no. No, I'm serious. I want that.
For like 10 years.
And so every time he'd come by, it would be like, remember, that's mine. Then we lost it. We moved to a new studio.
And somehow...
And we lost it. And I still don't know what happened to that...
Nobody knows.
...baby raccoon riding a bullfrog. So when he and Miranda got married... We had one made. We couldn't find a baby raccoon, but this guy had a baby possum. So that's even better.
Yeah.
It's a possum.
Yeah.
So we had this freaking bullfrog with a baby possum on it. And then we actually brought it to him as a wedding gift.
And he was so happy.
I've never seen him happier.
Like, sincerely, like it was the greatest thing he'd ever received. He was like, boys, I just want to cry. You know how he does his little thing. He's like, this is
Miranda
the best.
Was not
I was about to
happy.
Say we didn't realize we were also making an enemy that day because every time for the next 3-4 years we saw Miranda, it was if you only knew how much I hate that thing.
She made him move it out into like the guy area, like the bar area, and he put it up on top of a freezer, and
so she couldn't reach it.
So she couldn't get to it, and I think one of us or a listener, somebody was going through a magazine. You know, they kind of
Country Weekly. There was a picture.
Yeah, and that's him, you know, in his bar. And in the background, you see that taxidermy on top of a freezer. Yeah.
I wonder if he still got that one. Because we had a little placard and everything. It was like congrats
I'd say
and
he
all that.
Probably.
Maybe took the placard off?
Yeah, no, I'd say his lawyers probably try to.
Divide it.
You get that, you know. She was probably happy. She's probably happy to see that go. Yeah. It was when Taylor Swift's display was at the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum. Mm-hmm. When it was there, was she really hands-on?
She's hands-on in everything that she does, and we still have Taylor Swift items for display. We have the Taylor Swift Education Center, where we educate Taylor Swift.
You're right.
She gave us...
That's your Vince Gill joke right there. That's very Vince Gill. Yeah.
But she's involved in anything that has her name on it in a really present and cool way. She's a fascinating person to me, really.
Super smart.
Super smart, self-aware in a good way. She does neat stuff too. She one day, you know, she'll like troll her fans online. And one day she sees that there's a fan who's coming, I think it was from Kansas City, and said, "Wow, my first getting on the plane for my first trip to Nashville. First stop, Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum, Taylor Swift Education Center." So Taylor calls her day-to-day person and says, "What are we doing this afternoon?" And that person said, "I don't know. What are we doing?" Taylor said, "We're going to go to the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum." We stuck Taylor back, I swear
behind
to
glass?
You, right next to the taxidermied squirrels.
Oh, that's great.
I'm not kidding.
That's she's awesome. Behind, not a coincidence. Behind, this is just, yeah.
Right, she's behind this door, and she's hanging out and talking with staff. And finally, this girl comes through, and she stops.
But you know what? Because you've seen the picture, so you're just kind of
right.
Tracking
she's online.
Her.
Yeah, yeah. You can totally stalk anybody these days.
Yeah, yeah.
And this little girl was being stalked by Taylor Swift. So she's standing in front of Taylor's dress from the 1989 World Tour, and just big eyes looking at this thing. And quietly from behind the door, Taylor walks out and says, "Hey, Jenny, I'm Taylor. Thanks for coming to my place." And
so great.
And there were medical personnel around
just in case.
A heart incident. It was so cool, and it was also cool that there were no photographs. There's no,
pictures of that anywhere.
She took pictures
like security camera footage.
I'm sure there is that, but she took pictures with the girl, and then she went into a classroom where kids were getting edumacated in one of the classrooms there, learning how to write songs, and she talked to them. And But it wasn't like a news event where we're going to call Channel 5 or we're going to Access Hollywood's going to come down and show everybody what a nice person
she just did it to be cool.
Yeah.
Like, how cool would it be just to freak somebody out and go, "This is part of the exhibit. We have Taylor Swift
actually here." Well, I mean, the fact that at the time Taylor was, let me do the math in my head, she's like 27 years old now, right? So at the time that she donated money for an entire new, you know, half a wing of the museum, she was in her early 20s and at the top of her game. And, like, who does that? Like, nobody even thinks, you know. The artists who support the Hall of Fame the most fervently are the people who are in it. And then, you know, Vince Gill and Keith Urban are just superstars in that arena of promoting the Hall of Fame. And then Taylor Swift donated, what, like, it was over $1 million. $4 million.
I believe it was four. The Brett Favre of $1 million donations.
Wow.
Four. That's
a lot of money.
I thought it was only a million.
Right.
But
right.
I'm,
yeah. Well, you know, she gets that. I remember when she gave $50,000 to the New York City public school system, and people were mad at her because that wasn't enough. Like,
why don't you pitch in then?
It's like when my friend Todd Snyder handed a guy who was panhandling for money, handed him a $5 bill, and the guy's like, "You ain't got anything more?" And Todd actually pulled out a 20 and gave it to him.
That's when I go and I take my money back.
Man,
I'm like, "You don't appreciate this? Well, you're not going to get any of it."
But I do want
good for her, man.
She's something. But I do want to say, you mentioned artists supporting the Country Music Hall of Fame Museum. It's incredible to me. I feel like the museum does right by the artist, and I feel like they do right by the museum. I mean, we have people playing these All for the Hall concerts for no dough. We had last year in Los Angeles, Chris Stapleton and James Taylor and Casey Musgraves up there on stage at this event that's raising money and awareness for the museum. We have donations coming in from people who understand that we're here to be the preservationist for this history, that are giving us priceless objects and entrusting us with that. There's ways to give beyond just handing over $4 million, and there are a lot of people who do that. It's a community effort.
I've had people ask me, "What if I'm going to go to Nashville and I want to see a concert when I'm there?" And I guess I should go to CMA Fest. Yes, you should. It's great, but it's usually sold out now. The last 3 or 4 years, the nightly concerts are sold out in advance. That if you can go to Nashville and see one concert, wait until they announce an All for the Hall show, because you will never see anything like it anywhere else. It's the most, I mean, it's Keith Urban and Vince Gill.
That's a big fundraiser event.
Keith Urban and Vince Gill open the show, and then they stay on stage and play guitar, two of the best guitarists in the history of country music, play guitar and sing background vocals with everybody else who comes out. So it's like, oh,
and
here's
Luke
Bryan.
And it's everybody
and
else
everybody
who comes
gets
out.
Two songs. It's like, oh, here's Luke Bryan to come out and sing, and Keith Urban and Vince Gill are playing guitar behind him. And here's Willie Nelson and Keith Urban and Vince Gill. It's like you'll never go anywhere else and see a show where the backing band is Keith Urban and Vince Gill.
Yeah.
I've been three times. Every time I leave going, that's most incredible.
What was the best lineup? What year?
Well, and again, I'm going to sound like a homer, but it was because Bo Cephas was there. It was the same night Willie Nelson was there, and that was the only time there was no Keith Urban and Vince Gill. Bo Cephas came out by himself and sat down with an acoustic guitar and did like a medley
of songs, and it was like, God, it was incredible.
We've got to get Bosefus in the studio just to do that.
Just one time.
I mean, just one time, and just have it happen just once. Because he really is. We've had him on the show several times, but never played. To have him play in here would be the ultimate.
It's powerful, man. It's powerful when he's in a room playing and singing. What's your favorite Bosefus album, Patrick?
Habits Old and New is my favorite album. It has Dinosaur on it that was never even a single. And it has
Everybody Knows.
And Everybody Knows that song anyway. And it's just really powerful. That, I think that's the one that has the Blues Man on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's my favorite Bosefus.
You mean that Alan Jackson song?
Yeah. Yes, that Alan Jackson song.
I can remember who redid it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so good. I'm a big fan of course, you know, Bosefus, the bearded 1975 to 1992 era.
See, my Bosefus album is Almera Project.
That's a great record.
That whole blues thing he was doing, that's just.
T-Tot song.
Yes, all of it is just great.
I like
big,
the New
big
South.
Big Top Women. What, is that it?
Big Top Women, yeah. I like the New South album that Waylon co-produced with Richie Albright when Waylon got busted in 77. Wow. And it's got
for producing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
For some of what was produced.
For possessing, I think.
For possessing.
as he said, yeah, got busted for possession of something I didn't even, well, anyway, that's a country music history story for another day, but I love the looseness of that album. And Bosefus is so funny, you know. Last fall we elected the man from Plains, and there was lots of talk about some big change. But the Atlanta Braves, they still lose too many games, and the New South, thank God, is still the same.
You know? Yeah, it's the best.
I mean, I think the lyrics of "Country Boy Can't Survive" are still America. You can drive 30 miles outside any city and find that America. It doesn't matter what part of the country
you're in. That song is very, it echoes the same feeling as I think a lot of country music fans love that we're the underdog, but we're super strong, but it's mute, it's understated.
Proud of who we are, but we don't brag about it.
We don't boast about it.
Yet here's our song about boasting about it.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, like this Cowboy's Hat, Chris LeDoux. Mm-hmm. That is a great song that every time I hear it, I'm just like, yeah! And
you can't, it's one that you can't turn off.
No. Nope.
Like Chris LeDoux, this Cowboy Hat starts, you stop.
Yeah, the original where he talks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know,
there's a remake.
Yeah.
See,
yeah,
the only version I know, you know, is the one where he talks.
Yeah, and I've heard the other one, and it's still him. But I was kind of like, the timing's not the same. You know, just different. You know, but those songs are great, and "Country Boy Can't Survive" is, God,
I mean,
"Simple Man."
Charlie Daniels played the fiddle on "Family Tradition." Like that's one of those things. When I found that out, I couldn't wait to come in here and tell that story. I'm like, Charlie Daniels played the fiddle on three or four Hank Williams Jr. records in the 70s because they're like hanging out. He's like, hey, man.
Well,
like,
Charlie's up for that. You know, at our museum, we've got a display. Right now we have an exhibit called Dylan Cash and the Nashville Cats, and it spotlights all the significant musicians of the 60s who were in early 70s who were allowing all this new music to come into Nashville, Paul McCartney and the Byrds and all this. They came here because the players who were here could pull
Dina Carter's
this off.
Dad was a...
Fred Carter, yeah.
Fred Carter was a guitar player.
One of the people we spotlight is Charlie Daniels because he was all over the Bob Dylan records that were here. And Leonard Cohen, when Cohen came here, Daniels is playing for him in the studio.
A few months ago, Dina was here and she showed us a picture of her dad and Bob Dylan and Charlie Daniels in the studio all playing together. I'm like, can you imagine how good... We're talking the best players in the world still live in this town.
Oh, if we had a session 1 hour from now, a recording session, we had to make an album. You know, they'd be at the studio with a half an hour to spare setting up. I mean, it's incredible. And when you talk to people from other places, like I remember Art Garfunkel from Simon and Garfunkel came down here to record, and he could barely record because he was so astounded by the talent of the musicians and the way everybody reads these funny looking charts and just instantly makes music together that sounds like music.
We had some jingles that were written and performed by
Which ones? Are you
the first ones. Luke Reed. So Luke Reed had written these Big D and Bubba jingles a long time ago that were Texas Swing, because that was the kind of the hot thing, you know, sound at the time, and it was super cool. And we had five of them. And then, gosh, this was 2001, okay. I think. We redid them Bluegrass. So I went to Ricky Skaggs' studio in Hendersonville, Tennessee, and sat there with Mark Fain and Ricky Skaggs' whole band, Kentucky Thunder, while they recut. And that was my first experience of sitting in a studio with these guys. And then Mark listens to the tape. They're each 30 seconds long. He listens to the tape one time and goes, all right, 1-5-6-7, 1-5-6, 1-5-7, and hands out little sheets to everybody. Yeah. And they literally went into the studio and in one take nailed it. And it was like, how was that? That was the coolest thing I've ever seen in my life.
This is weird.
How was that?
Mark Fain is playing with me tonight at Station Inn, and we were rehearsing last night, and he was doing the exact same thing.
The Big D and Bubba jingles?
Yes. The entirety of my set will be Big D and Bubba. It's weird. He did it that one time, and he just keeps handing those out.
Them out. It's crazy. Yeah. It's, but no, he's
kind of obsessed
so
with it.
So talented, they can just, you know. Because I remember the youngest guy was a fiddle player. He was, at the time, I want to say this guy was 19 or 20.
Justin Moses?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He came in, and he just goes, okay, here's your chart. Because they did everything, and then the fiddle was last. And it was like, all right, I think I got it. And he went in there, and it was like, oh my God. How you didn't make that? I mean, it wasn't written down. There was no sheet music, and he didn't make it up on his own. It was kind of like he heard it once and went, I can match that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Makes you mad. You just go, God, I can't even open up tortilla chip bag without it going down the side. I ruined another one.
Yeah. You heard the podcast theme. That's as good as I can do. Yeah. That's it.
That's,
you know,
pretty good.
It was not bad. No, it's not bad.
It's catchy.
I want to remind you to get the book from Peter Cooper. It's called Johnny's Cash and Charlie's Pride. You can get it, I guess, anywhere, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
anywhere that's reasonable. Yeah.
Anywhere that's reasonable. Yeah. Again, looking for Peter Cooper. He's the senior director, producer, and writer at the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum. Highly, highly, highly recommend. If you are making a trip to Music City, or you are already in Music City, go to this piece of history for our music, and you're going to get educated. I get educated today from you. I didn't realize, you know, the stuff with the steel guitar and how that was groundbreaking and not, you know, trying to break it. I didn't know all that.
You just thought it had always been
around. I thought that was like the original, and I thought that's the way it was. So you get educated.
You know what I love about the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum is the fact that it's a piano. Like, you look at it and it looks like a building, and then you realize if somebody goes, oh, you know, it's a piano, and you go, no, it's not.
Yes,
it is a piano.
Yeah. I'm going to make a pitch for the Hall of Fame. I don't think I've ever done this. So
you want to be in the Hall of Fame?
No. Yes, I do. I am a member of what's called the Troubadour Society. So if you live in, you can be anywhere in the country and join, but especially if you live in Nashville or the surrounding area, you can join the Hall of Fame, pay the same price as a normal membership. And if you're under 45, you can become a member of what's called the Troubadour Society, and you can go to every members only event that they, just like if you had a regular membership, but they also have four special events just for Troubadour Society members every year. So for the same price, without paying any more, you get to go to these special things where we get to see the exhibits after hours. We get to, you know, and drink wine and eat cheese.
Why are we not members of this?
Okay. Are you?
Yes.
Are you under 40?
Yes, I'm under 40. Yes.
I'm doing the math in my head. Yes, you are. Okay,
I'm 39.
That's right.
Don't forget.
That's right. Bubba is perpetually 39.
That's a cool society.
It's a really cool thing, and it's shocking to me always. I said socking. That
did you say socking?
I did
it's
say socking.
Wow.
Okay.
You have to, when you screw up a word, Peter, in the studio, you just might as well admit it because they'll pounce.
Okay.
Immediately afterwards. It's shocking to me sometimes how few people are in it. I think we have right around 500 members, and I'm like, oh my gosh, it's $60. $60 a year. You can't buy the beer and the wine and the cheese you will eat at the four. If you go of the things,
that's right.
It's like it's a fantastic way to you know, see the Hall of Fame in a different light. And you remember, you can go anytime you want.
Yeah, and that's, I think you're bringing up great points also about the education process of walking through that building. But I want to underscore it. You will get educated when you're there, but you're also going to have a blast, and you're going to be surprised and delighted by the things that are in this museum. One of the members of the Country Music Hall of Fame is Cowboy Jack Clement, who is a marvelous, just incredible guy. And he would stop recording sessions. If things weren't going well, he would say into the what's called the talkback microphone, he'd say to the musicians, "Hey, remember, we're in the fun business. If we're not having fun, we're not doing our jobs." And we take that real seriously at the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum. That's, it's got to be fun. If this is great. Not fun, then we should just, you know, sell something.
We have that conversation about once a week in here. Because we really look at what we do. We play country music and try to be funny for a living. If we're not having fun, we should really, you know.
Yeah.
Sockingly.
There's other stuff to do.
Some people don't have fun when they work in radio or in the music industry.
Peter, thank you for coming by and being a part of the podcast, man. It's been really fun and educational. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a blast to be here. You guys are great.
Yes, we are.
Hey, the podcast is brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Remember, it's Memorial Day weekend. Put your seatbelt on. If you don't use your seatbelt, you could end up in a hospital bed, and that would suck. That would absolutely be the worst thing ever. So buckle up. Well, actually, the worst thing ever is you don't even get to go to the hospital bed. You get to go to the mortuary. And that's,
I think you're off script.
Yeah, I think you went off script a little
bit. I'm just saying, this
it's
is
Memorial
serious.
Day weekend.
Put
buckle up.
Your seatbelt on. Buckle up before it's too late.
Don't drink and drive.
Don't drink and drive. Awesome, brilliant. Remember, you don't get a second chance. Click it or ticket. And Peter, thank you, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
This was the podcast, but now it's over. But that's okay, because you can listen to the regular show on the radio every day. It was the podcast.